Hey, Happy New Year. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Marvin Kaye, an actor who's appeared in The Handmaid's Tale, The Strain, The Expanse, and Murdoch Mysteries, among dozens of other things. As a writer and producer, he created the charming dramedy Less Than Kind, and he's prepping a new web series, Hit on Me, with the actor and producer Elizabeth Whitmire. You can see him as the burly Russian in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, and that's pretty cool. Marvin picked Breaker Morant, Bruce Beresford's 1980 adaptation of Kenneth Ross's stage play about three Australian soldiers on trial for war crimes and the officer appointed to defend them. One of the biggest hits to come out of the Aussie New Wave, it features terrific performances from Edward Woodward, Jack Thompson, and Brian Brown, among others, as well as an unnervingly blunt approach to the subjects of morality, trauma, and violence. We're going to get into spoiler territory, but that's inevitable with a picture like this. We do get into spoiler territory, but that's sort of inevitable when discussing a picture like this. The picture itself has a certain inevitability when you think about it. This is someone else's movie.
It's one of those movies that whenever it came on, I think it must have come on with Saturday Night at the Movies a few times, and I always watched it. And I think there's some brilliant acting. There's these noble characters in war, and it's so horrible, and it felt so good to watch these heroes who die at the end. The performances, the direction, the rawness of it, I just always loved the movie, and it was just one of these movies I kept watching. And when I was dating my wife, I actually introduced her to it, and I think it was a Saturday Night at the Movies, because that was our cheap date. cheap date night. We'd watch that. And whenever it came on, I was like, you have to watch this movie. And it was just, there was something so compelling about the story and all of the performances that I always fell in love with the movie every time I saw it.
Okay. And what was your first experience of it? How old were you? When did you see it?
Well, I mean, it came out in 1980, so yeah. I would have been, I probably did not see it in the theaters then. I would have been,
I was 12.
Yeah. So I doubt I would have gotten it then. I would think that it must have been seeing it on the TV or something after that. But I do remember Saturday Night at the Movies, and I saw it before that. But I can't recall when. Mm. But it probably was one of those broadcasts where they'd broken up with commercials and stuff like that in those days. Yeah. But it was I just found it to be a very compelling show. Like all the performances, the locations, just that whole war at the turn of the century thing, and you know when I got older and there was more of a context. A conscious context to the horrors of war and what men have to do in war. And then I appreciated that side of the story. But I've always been pulled towards those sort of stories. How nobility is lost and humanity is lost in a war. And the Boer War was pretty brutal. Yeah. And their depiction of it was not bad. I mean, it's not as grotesque. They actually avoid a lot of the gross war. It's like not a Mel Gibson sort of show the leg spouting blood sort of movie. But the performances and the results of that horror and how they change those men is very dramatic in the show.
Yeah, it surprised me watching it again. I hadn't seen it in about probably 10 years. The first time I saw it was the Laserdisc. I had this memory clearly of the film playing forever in Toronto because it just did. There were three foreign language or foreign imports that played for 2 or 3 years in the late 70s and early 80s. It was La Cage aux Folles, Breaker Morant, and then later The Gods Must Be Crazy. And they just played and played and played. And so Breaker Morant was at the Eaton Center forever. I walked past the poster all the time. I just never went in. And when the Laserdisc came out in 86 or 87, there was this label that had they got Breaker Morant and the Light Horseman, and there was a third one, but this wave of Australian cinema that they clearly licensed suddenly showed up.
Now, was that sort of like, was he riding the wave of Australian cinema at that time? So it's 1980.
Yeah, so it's after The Last Wave and Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yeah, okay. And all of that stuff.
Cars That Ate Paris. But yeah, I think it was in...
full swing that Beresford's first international breakthrough just sort of emerged that way.
And it was a play beforehand.
It was.
And that I didn't know that till way later into it that I was like, oh. And you can see the elements of the play in it when you rewatch it now, because the way they the courtroom scenes, I mean, that's all very theatrical. Like there wasn't a lot of like war scenes. There weren't a lot of like explosions, like I said earlier, but the tension in the courtroom and all of the machinations and the strategies that were being used, it was such a great character driven film. Once I found out it was a play, it was easy to see the play within the screenplay.
Yeah, well, that really stood out on this viewing. That and there's a sort of, it's not flatness exactly, but it's a dispassionate approach cinematically.
Yeah.
The battle sequences, the flashbacks that we see are all very conventionally shot.
Yes.
And the trial itself of the court-martial, there are shots above, there are shots to the side, there are strange canted, canted angle exactly, but sort of a canted stage approach to it. Mm-hmm. And an absolute lack of music, which I didn't remember. There's some singing. And yes. There's a piece of score at the very, very end. But otherwise, there's nothing.
Yeah, it's very quiet that way.
Yeah,
but
it's sort of left with it.
Yeah, and it's part of the characters too. It emphasizes how eloquently he spoke in the courtroom. The Morant character, mm-hmm. like when they accuse him and when they say, you know, when you executed those prisoners, did you have a courtroom like this? And he stands and he does that speech, which is so intense, but it's so theatrical. And, you know, a lot of times when movies go all talky-talky, when the play thing happens they use a lot of dialogue, you can really sense the play of the screenplay, but I never got that sense in here. It felt right for the way they were doing the characters and the way it was shot, that it didn't stand out that much to me. Like when I saw Denzel Washington's Fences, he's like, oh man, you didn't change a word of it. Or it looked, I don't know, I could be talking on my ass, but it didn't look like he changed a word of the play. Cause it's just like, it sounds like a play. It's shot very much like in the very simple, just like boom, boom, boom. And everybody's this reams of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it's not that there's any bad, but you go, oh, that's a play.
Yeah, well, it's so respectful of the source that it refuses to turn it into cinema.
Yeah.
And with Breaker Morant, and there are a handful of films, Beresford did this again with Driving Miss Daisy. Like, he finds a way to activate the text, to get it outside of people standing still.
Well, I think it's using the camera and using it, adapting it for the medium, so that it doesn't feel kind of like an alien, like it's been shoved into a frame.
Right.
Whereas I that was my issue with Fences. I mean, I thought like beautiful performances, but like I was like, it feels like a play. It felt like a play. It was like I would love to see them do this on a live stage, but for the cinema, I wish he would have twisted it a bit. Now the movie got praised at the Yang, and it should. For all the performances and stuff, but it felt like a play to me. That was my only criticism of it.
It's fine. It's a record of of a show. I felt that way. Actually, no, I felt the other way. I'm thinking of the going in the opposite direction with something like August, Osage County, where they just go so hard into this is a movie now, and it just won't stop bothering you with how cinematic it is and how beautiful this shot is and how the lighting is twinkling here and how these actors are all in the same space. But with Breaker Morant, if you didn't know, it would still play.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't worry about it. Plus, if you think about it as a stage play, then all the flashback sequences, all the military stuff makes no sense. How do you even begin to hint at that? So why would you think of this as a play based on the structure?
Yeah, I didn't find out until after I'd seen it like three times that it was a play first and he adapted it. I love the nobility of the characters. I love all the performances are great. The pompous British officials in it are so great. All those character actors that they got for the jury. The head guy, I can't remember. I don't know his name.
The tribunal.
Yes. The tribunal, and with his mustache. They're so perfect. Those performances are so great. And Woodward himself is so wonderful. Jack Thompson, God.
Yeah, a young Jack Thompson who has somehow never been young.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I remember seeing that. And what was the television show he had? It was adapted to a TV show.
Man from Snowy River.
Man from Snowy River. No.
And there was an Australian film that never went away.
But it was the Stuntman, wasn't? God, what the hell was it? What the hell series was it? FX. It was something FX?
Or that's Brian Brown.
Brian Brown, yeah. Brian Brown. Sorry. Brian Brown. I got the names blurred in my face. That's where I remembered him from. I remember when I saw the movie, I was like, oh, that's the guy from that series.
Yeah.
But, you're right.
Jack Thompson.
Jack Thompson.
The
lawyer guy, yeah.
Yeah.
He was great in that. They're all so good. I am so riveted by those sort of character performances, and it's really interesting and very compelling to watch those sort of actors show their moves like that on cinema. And it's really a tribute to some really great writing and some really great acting to be able to do that with not a lot of flashy, crazy camera moves or special effects. Mm-hmm.
Even the nature of the material means it's going to be very contained and coiled. And
yeah.
I think the first time that Woodward barks that someone's lying is genuinely shocking.
Yeah.
He just springs up.
Yeah. And it's the tone, the speech, and the way he's so poised in his character. There's the scene where they're shaving at the sink it's such a great acting study, and you know, my days as an actor, where you can see, like, as he's shaving, he's polishing his stuff as he's finishing it and putting it down in order. And you see,
Brian Brown,
he's sort of the laissez-faire rock star kind of soldier. And he just, like, even as he walks into the courtroom, he's kind of got that, like, just slouchy sort of appeal to him. And you just see, like, these characters are so iconic. And it was, I think it's such a great, they're all such great actors, and they just, they were very precise in what they were doing on that movie.
Mm-hmm. And it also nicely delineates the space between the English career soldier and the Australian.
Yeah.
Sort of, maybe not a conscript, but a recruit.
Somebody yeah, well.
He's an officer, but he's not terribly high placed.
Which,
Brian Brown's character.
Yeah, but he also says, some point in the movie, he says he volunteered because there was no work at home.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
There was no work at home, and the war was happening, so he thought he could make some money.
Yeah.
Doing this for his family.
That's right. $300 for something.
Yeah, and something like that. So you know, and so he goes there, and he's screwing around on his wife and all that stuff, and he's a playboy, he's a hustler, and you just see it. And he's the one who calls out, I think, the first witness who. In the movie, the first witness who lies, he's the first one who calls him out and says, you know, and tells him off,
right,
in the stand. And he's just such a charming character, like good looking, doesn't give a shit. He's gonna say it, tell it like it is, guy.
Yeah.
And then you've got the poet sitting next to him, which is Woodward's character, and then the little innocent, which is who's the actor?
I can't remember. He's got an odd hyphenated name that I've seen him in dozens of things.
Louis Fitzgerald?
Fitzgerald.
Yeah, and they hyphenate Fitz and Gerald.
It is, yeah. And that is correct. That is how it's always been spelled. And that it always stands
did
out.
Did he do... I never looked him up. Did he do much?
He's doing all kinds of stuff, yeah. Oh, okay. I mean, you've seen him. He's also...
One of those journeyman actors who's always sort of in...
He's in every Australian thing.
Oh, okay.
Drama after drama after drama.
And he plays, like, the wide-eyed innocent, like, how is this happening? Why would they come after us sort of thing? And, I'm like, oh, it's just very classically constructed. The movie charms me every time, and even the final line of the movie. What does he say? Like, you know, shoot well, you bastards! Don't screw this up! Don't screw this up!
Apparently true,
but
it's what the guy said.
Well, you get it then. Like, you can't write something that good. Like, you have to have somebody say that. It's so heroic and sad.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I...
And it's not delivered as a big hero moment either. It's just barked out.
And they're not big heroes. I was reading something about it before I came here, like, that the Beresford was kind of freaked out a bit that the movie was taken as how horrible the Brits were to the Australians. The movie was treated as sort of a vindication of these Australian soldiers, when he really wanted it to be a movie about what the horrors of war, what war makes men do.
Right.
Because what they did was terrible. He never, and even in the movie, he doesn't say, they admit to all of the horrible things, like shooting prisoners and all of that. As just, that's what war is, and you put us in war, and this is what you're going to get,
right.
And it's, you know, condemning war, and it does you can't help but feel something for these soldiers who do get shit on by the system,
yeah,
and it's, they end up being these noble heroes that die in the end,
yeah. In a weird way, it's the standard ending for most war movies.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of, you know, not only Paths of Glory, which is sort of the obvious analog, but even A Few Good Men ends the same way, with the, you know, we fail to protect them, that's why we're guilty.
Yeah.
The idea that...
It's a little bit more blunt in its delivery.
Well, that, but, yeah. Sorkin.
Yeah.
Yeah. But with Breaker Morant and Paths of Glory lining up together in my mind in a way that almost makes the specifics of the war unnecessary. I mean, really, this could have been any military conflict. That's the other thing, too. The setting makes it precise and specific,
yeah.
and the nature of the people involved, but it does definitely feel like an indictment of the colonial attitude and everything that was going on militarily for a century. And that doesn't make it any better.
Yeah.
Just the idea that this is always going to happen to people, that there will always be sacrificial lambs, and the officers will be... or the officers above will simply be allowed to feel bad about this necessary evil.
And, you know, they can blame the doing of the evil on the people who carry out their orders.
Right. It's always a bad apple.
It's very interesting. It's funny when you said location. It's like, has there been any other movie about the Boer Wars?
Not that I can think of. There are films in which people return from them. Right?
Yeah.
That's their distinction.
There's never anything where it's like... Because it was such a... I remember when I watched it was such a weird war. Like, you have to look it up. Like, the what wars?
Yeah.
Between, like, the Dutch
and the British.
And the British?
In Pretoria.
What? Yeah. In Pretoria? What the hell was that? Why? I guess, gold, oil, jewels.
Well, it's like the Spanish-American War. It's there, but nobody ever really goes into it. It's always used as backdrop.
Yeah. But this one, like, they actually were there. I think there's something about that, and it has that indie film 70s feel to it still, even though it's in the 80s. It still, when I watched it, I was thinking about, like, all those 70s movies that era felt sort of gritty,
right,
and real, and yeah. So that's another reason I think that movie charms me.
Yeah, it's such an unlikely art house hit, too.
Is it, feels
like it now, because. When you look back through the prism of, 38 years ago, there was this big wave of cinema that no one had ever seen before. And this one feels like a curiosity more than... I mean, you look at La Cage aux Folles, and as retrograde as it is, you can see why it was a hit.
Yeah.
And Picnic at Hanging Rock, and those were films that were evocative and strange. You could point to them and say, oh, this is a different kind of cinema. Breaker Morant is incredibly conventional for the most part. Like, it pitches normally. It sounds like a regular movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always been surprised every time, because I came to it just long enough after the fact, after its premiere, that this was a thing that kept playing for a year. This got people in the room. It's a courtroom drama. Why? What's so special about it? But then I think the exoticism of all of those pieces that you have, and English actors and Australian actors, and you have this location that isn't quite immediately, it almost is surrealized or stylized in a way that would seem exotic to people.
I think that's a really good way to put it, because when I rewatched it recently, you know, it doesn't feel like any other movie. Like, it's got, like, some elements of a Western kind of feel, but it's not. And then it has, like, that British war feel, but it's not. And it's this strange little amalgam of everything, and done in a very, very simple, understated way in a lot of the way it was shot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. It is just a courtroom drama, essentially. Like, most of the intense scenes are there.
But something about it picks at you. And you just can't dismiss it.
And I go back. I think, you know, those. I think their performances and there. When a play is adapted, we were talking about adaptations before. When a play is adapted well, when something it just has the privilege of being rehearsed and gone over a thousand times. You can see the precision in the words and in the craftsmanship of it. And I know it gets all ripped apart in editing, and when they do it as a screenplay, they readapt it. But they have the themes and the construction of what that person was trying to say, what the writer was trying to say, has been worked on and worked on and worked on for years and years. And you get a sense when something really good has been adapted. Like, you go, like, the characters are all, they know what they want. They all have goals. Like, it's all those basic things. Right. All the bases are covered. Everybody, there's been a lot of work, and everything is, all the bows are tied the way they should be.
Right. And of course, you can't get any more urgent than I don't want to die.
Yeah.
And the only other opposition is characters who don't want to lose a case, which is almost as important, because they're fighting for these people's lives. And then there are characters who are trying to suppress the truth, which, again, pretty urgent, can't really... Yeah. You know.
Like, everybody had... Their goals are so specific, and I think that really helps when you're watching these kind of movies, is, like, you know what everybody wants, and you know the obstacles in their path, and it's just... And that's good writing and good direction and good construction. And then, you know, you get a good ensemble of actors, which I still stress that these are all really great ensemble actors. Like, the character actors, all the little actors in it are great.
Yeah.
Again, the British Tribunal guys are so... You just hate them so much. They're such assholes. They're such arrogant pricks. You go... That it's you really make, that, I think that's what makes you cheer for the Australians and makes you feel like they need to be the vindication. It's the total vindication of these guys, because the other guys are such dicks.
Yeah,
that you want these guys to be heroes, and they're really not heroes. They were they committed war crimes.
Yeah,
even in modern day they would have been tried and convicted. But yet somehow this play makes them seem heroic.
Yeah, and with hindsight too, difference culturally now, how we interpret military stories and how we're automatically on side with the enlisted men. I mean, that's cinema, right? That you're always, it's an underdog story.
Yeah.
But there's something about this film that made me understand, maybe in a way that maybe other war films at the time weren't really exploring it. Gallipoli certainly doesn't have any of that. It's about dying with honor, but dying.
Yeah.
This is a film about people who are suffering from the acts that they've committed.
Yes.
Which wasn't really a thing in 1980. I mean, you kind of got it with Coming Home, but again, in a completely different context. Yeah. Here you have a film about brutalization and people who have lost themselves and who are still hurting and suffering over it. Like, Woodward, and especially Woodward, he's just so rigid in a way that kind of speaks to career soldier, but also kind of speaks to a man who's barely holding it together after everything he's seen.
Well, it's also like I think it's an earlier in the movie, they say, you know, he's a poet, he's a writer, and then there's the scene where he's like singing opera at one point. So they made him like this total
voice.
Yeah. Yes, he was a singer, the actor.
It's really jarring too, because at least in the current sound mix on the Blu-ray, it sounds like he's dubbed. So it may have simply been singing the playback.
No, I'm sure.
But it's him. It's definitely Woodward.
But you put that beside the fact that these guys were... like, they committed war crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a very... And I guess in 1980, it would be very difficult to find movies that dealt with that sort of damaged heroes.
Yeah. I mean, you had anti-heroes, but you didn't have that sort of thing. I mean, I guess the Deer Hunter and Coming Home together. But there are different explorations, and the war in Vietnam is perceived to have been the great, you know, destruction of the American military. Like, soldiers didn't come back the same.
Same, yeah.
And
they weren't fighting for the same things.
Yeah, and what we see of the Boer War in Breaker Morant, it was ugly but clean. They like fought with honor in a way that maybe Vietnam wasn't, but who knows? I mean, it's clearly a guerrilla tactics situation by the time we get there.
Well, yeah, and they talk about it. Like, this was a war fought. And it was interesting, there was a section of dialogue where they talk about, like, this is a war fought like no other war. And it's interesting when you think about what's happening now and what happened in Vietnam and all that, like how universal that is, like that is used as an excuse to justify these horrific tactics. And there actually is a speech. The lawyer has a speech that men, you know, if you throw men into these horrible situations, don't expect them not to to fight horribly, you can't expect civilized men to act civilized in the most uncivilized place.
Right.
And when their lives are depending on it. And then, I think that speaks to, I think, really good writing where they've just, he's stating like a universal theme here that echoes for not just the 80s, the 90s, and now. I mean, yeah. you see the same thing. So that, I think that's another reason I love it. You know, I love stories, those sort of stories with guerrilla fighters and all that kind of stuff. I've always been a fan of it. Maybe it's because my father was kind of into that, or was a guerrilla fighter, actually. So
where, when?
We're going to go to my dad's story.
What's the context?
My dad was in Poland when Hitler invaded. And he was in a small town just outside of Warsaw, like 100 kilometers north. So the tanks roll in, and he was in a school. He's in school. Basically, the teacher said, you know, everybody go home. And he, some kids went home, some kids ran into the forest to hide. And he ran into the forest to hide and then met up with the Russian underground. And they basically said, come with us or you're going to die out here. And then he spent most of World War II like running through the forest as a child soldier. And I was thinking about that when I was coming here, like, what is it about those movies? And it's like, there are, I mean, if there's like a good, you know, therapy session in there for me, there is that underlying theme, like, I have a connection to guerrilla soldiers through my father.
Yeah.
Because he fought that, and he was, you know, he survived that. And I saw what kind of a person, you know, and he came out of that, however damaged he was, whatever damage he had, he still held himself together fairly nobly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he had a very interesting story way.
Did he talk about it?
You know, it's funny, the year before he died, the summer before he died, I was going to theater school at the time, and I had this urge because I knew he was sick. And so I interviewed him, and I got him to talk about it the most he ever did. And he has some horrific stories about, you know, hiding in the bushes when the Germans are bayoneting the thing, and he got sliced across the knuckles, and he had a scar on his hand, and like the guy, one of the soldiers beside him, like grabbed his face so he couldn't scream, and they all hid there, and they waited till the soldiers passed, and you know, he had those stories, and you're getting shot in the ankle, and then having the Russian soldier like punch him out unconscious so that they could operate and fix him. And he says, I don't remember anything. And he just punched me. And I woke up in a stretcher being dragged through the forest. Jeez. And you know, you look at your dad telling you these stories going, are you just reciting like a movie script to me?
Yeah. You can't see these things happening to ordinary people.
Yeah. And there is like, when you've met somebody and when you've been raised by somebody who's lived through that, I think I must have a subconscious connection every time I see these scenes to all of those stories that he told of surviving that. And he didn't speak a lot about it. I don't think he never went into any gruesome details. I think the most harrowing detail story was like there was his job, and a whole bunch of kids would go and raid farmhouses and things like that, like steal food. Right. Basically, just disrupt the German any sort of supply line and raid for food. And he said that the German, they had raided a farmhouse, and then the German soldiers had come and were looking to see that, and they'd hidden, and a whole bunch of German soldiers went into the storm cellar, and he said, you know, we had some grenades, so we just opened the doors, threw it down, put a board in, and we walk away, and he never talked about anything else. And I said, and what happens next? He goes, we walk away. And you look at your dad and you go, okay. That's as far as you get from it. And so, you know, it just brings it home that like those scenes, as dramatic as they sound when you speak them, and you can see, you know, there's cinematic, and eventually one day I will write it. But they happen, and that's horrible.
Yeah.
And they're still happening. And it's more horrible that they're still happening and we have an awareness of it. So, you know, Breaker Morant maybe, you know, was based on something that happened in the 1900s.
Yeah, the trial was set in 1901.
1901. So. And I don't think the tactics that they talk about and all of the horrors that they talk about have changed very much in over 100 years.
Yeah. There's been no need. It always works. That's the worst part, right? And just basic resistance is...
Basic resistance, is guerrilla fighting.
It's killing people as horribly as possible in a small space.
And, you know, blaming people. I mean, you mentioned A Few Good Men. I mean, you see, like, those themes resonate even now.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's why these war movies, it's like this, it's like we want to punish ourselves. We want to watch these movies that remind us war is shitty. Why the fuck are we still doing this?
Yeah. Well, that's the other problem with war movies, right? Because I think it was Kubrick who said any movie about war, or no, it was Truffaut. One of them, either Kubrick or
you're
Truffaut.
You're so much more educated in film than I am.
If I could remember who said it, yes. But the line is, it's impossible to make an anti-war film because all film glorifies what it shows.
Yeah.
And there will be people who come out of Full Metal Jacket thinking, that was fucking awesome, you know, that sort of thing. And Breaker Morant's approach is to simply show people falling over.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost elegant in the depiction of violence, the way the people delivering the coup de grace are... Yeah. Way in the background, and we get to watch the echoes of the shot hit people, and even when characters are gunned down at the very end, it's the cut back to the kid,
yes,
registering that noise, and that speaks more than watching the bodies fall over.
And then I it makes me laugh every time, because just before they go out to be executed,
mm-hmm.
It's all right. The actor
Brian Brown.
Character, because they can hear the carpenters making the coffin on the other side of the wall, and he goes, the least they could do is, the least they could do is measure us for it to make sure it, and Woodward characters, because Breaker Morant's character says, well, I don't think they've ever gotten any complaints, which is a very funny line. Mm-hmm. And then when they're shot at the end and they're putting the bodies in, his character doesn't fit, and they have to like shove the legs in, and it's all happening right at the end, just before the credits are about to roll on it. And it's a great joke to throw in. And it's such a dark joke to throw in right at the end. It's like, it's...
Yeah, somebody thought about it.
Somebody saw it. Somebody thought that was going to be... Because it's very... Like, he's, you know, you see him put the body in the coffin, and they have to force the legs in. And you're like, oh, that's... I don't... It's just like one of those moments that stand out to me. Like, oh, that's sharply shot and shot. You know, this there that there's a humor and that this nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just war and death and horror, and it's just a part of the sausage factory. And you just put them in the box and they get rid of them. And there's something dark and funny about the acknowledgement of it, I guess.
Yeah, it's a profoundly unsentimental film about war.
Profoundly unsentimental.
And
you gotta be a writer.
That's what I mean. But you're just stuck with it, right? You're in the space with these people as they, not only as they realize their defense is boiling away, but as they sort of pick up the gallows humor at the same time, that nobody loses their minds, and the one person who probably would gets a life sentence instead of death, so that loosens the tensions a little bit. But then the hope of reprieve is taken away, and both Brown and Woodward just sort of roll into it with the stiff upper lip thing, and they're angry, but they're channeling it into the cynicism.
Yes, and there is it is like almost distilled cynicism that they have, because I think they even start the whole courtroom situation. They start it with this, like, we know we're getting set up here. Like, we know this is it. And but they hold on to the hope, and they struggle to try and maybe we'll beat this. But when it all starts to fall apart, they know. Yeah. And I think there's a point where Breaker Morant actually says, you know, to the lawyer, there's no point. This is all a show. They're going to blame us for this, and that's it. We're done. Mm-hmm. And they accept it. And I don't know how accurate a depiction is. Like, there's a, when the other guy who's going to be tried after them says, you know, there's some people who want to break you out. They said, we can get you on a horse and maybe you'll get out and go into Portuguese territory or something like that. He says, we can maybe, and he goes, well, where will I go? Portuguese territory, go see the world. And he goes, I've seen it.
Yeah.
And that's the ultimate cynic line, right?
Yeah.
You can escape, go see the world. Yeah. I've seen it.
Yeah. And this, on this viewing, it felt to me like he was saying he's only experienced it through war.
Yeah.
And he's seen how awful it is.
Yeah.
And that he has no interest in seeing, what's the line? It's from, it's Shakespearean. I think it's.
No, but is it the Byron poem thing?
No, it's not in the film. It's a line at the end of With Null and I, Man delights not me nor woman neither. He's just exhausted and there's
nothing left. And you get that sense of it, like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
That he accepts it because this is as good as it gets. It's horribly cynical. Oh my God, it makes me sad to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's horribly cynical. Like, this is as good as it gets. Like, why am I going to go into Portuguese territory and live out my life as like a man on the run? Just let it be done.
Die
just let
it be done. Versus freedom.
Yeah. I don't think there's, you know, I don't know, you know, getting shot by a firing squad at dawn. They do it as nobly as possible, but I know, you know, nobody dies. There's no honor in getting shot, shot in a firing line. It's just ugly and brutal and you're dead.
Yeah. And again, the film doesn't shy away from that either.
No.
I mean, there is that slow-mo violence thing that was popular at the time, but only in one shot, and it's not heroic at all.
No.
It's awful. You're meant to feel the impact of the bullets. It's not, it's the Peckinpah thing, but without glory.
Yeah,
not
there's
dying.
No
They're
glory.
They're dying
to
for
it.
Nothing.
Yeah. They're dying, because somebody said, well, in the movie, basically, and they do say, well, these men will sacrifice, and then after they die, they say, oh, you know, the armistice is, they're negotiating an armistice, so. Yeah. This will all work out. And it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, we're showing.
Well, we're all supposed to feel good about that?
Yeah, it's a show of good faith that we killed the bad apples that didn't actually, you know, have a say in whatever was happening.
That just we're just following orders.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. It really is, and it's so simple and it's elegant in that there is really maybe that's what it was, the downer ending that still feels like a victory somehow morally.
Well, yeah, and there's no preciousness about it. Like, I love those endings. And I'm a sucker for a downer ending, which is maybe my downfall as a person, too.
I was gonna say, you work in comedy.
Well, you know, the show I worked on, I never saw it strictly as a comedy, especially, you know, in the last few seasons, we were dealing with a whole bunch of stuff. And actually, when we pitched it, it was an hour-long sort of just dark show originally. Yeah, okay. we thought it would be like this crazy Driving School Family, 6 feet Under is what we were sort of modeling ourselves after. And the network came to us because they said they were a little interested. And they were like, could you do it as a half hour? And it was the first show we ever pitched. So I was like, when the network says, can you do it as a half hour?
Sure,
you go, yeah, of course we could do it as a half hour. We'll do it as a half hour standing on our heads. What do you want? And so we did it. And, you know, we work in comedy, but if you've ever been around comedians, they're the darkest, most cynical people in the whole fucking world.
Yes.
And there, you sit with a bunch of comedians in a room after a comedy night when they're starting to drink, and you will see, like, light is sucked out of the room. Like, there is such a pit of darkness in there. And you have to be able to laugh at it. And I think there's a gift to being able to take the darkest parts of life and laugh at it. And that's why that moment with the coffin, when sticking his leg, when they're shoving his legs down, that maybe that's the part of me that loves it. Maybe it's the comedy writer in me that just says, oh, like, that's a funny line. That's a funny bit.
Right.
Like, they just, even at the end, they're just giving a little joke going, look, I got to get that thing in there. Yeah. So... But yeah, but my show, it was funny, but we didn't aim directly at the funny. We were trying to do something. I don't want to talk like too nobly about it, but I think we tried to do something special.
Yeah, well, I mean, the comedy came out of the characters. It's not like it was a sitcom that was designed to put people in funny situations. But I mean, I laughed.
Oh no, no, and we wanted people
to
laugh.
It was a good feeling.
Yeah, and it was based, you know, on me growing up and Winnipeg and all of that, and we wanted it to be something. But we did. There were points where we would actually have conversations about balancing out the drama and the comedy, and like, it's a funny line, but it doesn't feel like it might be.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas some shows, I think, would say, you know, we got to stick that laugh in. We would sometimes shave the laugh off and go, you know, we're gonna have a downer ending. Like, we're just going to do it. And because that's what felt right, so...
Right. Oh, if that's what the material wants, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it, once you try to...
But we were, you know, we were in a very privileged situation when we... Especially when we made the jump to HBO, that we were like... They don't care. They were like, do whatever you want. And you don't have to have the commercial, the act break, the funny out at the act break to bring them back in. So we were in a very privileged situation to be able to just let our stories meander and turn into whatever they wanted.
Mm,
and,
sure.
And you know, I had a very blessed experience for my first show. That was like a really incredible, even McKinney and all those guys would look at us and go, guys, you don't know how lucky you are. And it wasn't until the show was over and I'd worked on a few other things where I was like, oh man, I was lucky. Like we got to do whatever we wanted. And if we felt like being funny one day, we could be funny. If we felt like we wanted to have some drama, we were able to do that. And there was nobody was questioning us because of who we were, who was working on it and where we were doing it.
That does not happen.
No. And we would get notes from the network that were like, you know, two lines. They would have like an issue with one or two things. It was rare to get like detailed notes. And then when you work on another show, you get like these reams of notes and you're like, oh geez.
Yeah, I've heard stories.
Yeah, no, and we got to do whatever we wanted. And I don't know if that was because of, you know, McKinney was on board and all these other people were contributing to this show and they just trusted it. And McKinney was sort of brilliant in dealing with the network and the notes as well. But yeah, it was a real privilege. Sorry, I didn't want to end up talking about my show.
No, it always happens. It's fine. It's sort of the best part of the, you know, when things organically flow into the work. That's what fascinates me.
But yeah, but in terms of it being, like, I never stressed that I was like strictly a comedy guy. But like when you sell something to the network, it's just much easier for people to categorize you.
Right.
So suddenly, like, oh, you're a half hour guy, and that just happens.
Right. No, but Hit on Me is funny.
Yeah, it is. It's dark, and I did that web series thing, you know, and we're still waiting to hear about funding for it. Mm-hmm. But I did it because I wanted to do something like that was really dark that nobody, like, you just don't see on TV, or at least on Canadian TV.
Right.
You know, you don't see anything like that dark. And that's funny, but I just finished writing my first 1 hour. Oh. I just handed in to my agent a week ago saying, you know, it's a murder mystery. It's weird. I don't. It's set in a mythical Hasidic village, like outside of Whitby.
Okay.
And the body of a Hasidic Jew turns up in a dumpster, like just outside the town of Brooklyn, with an eye.
Okay.
That is a town outside of Whitby, and then an investigation ensues that sort of does that. Cool. And so I wrote that, and my agent's going to pass that around, and we'll see about what the 1 hour world, how they take that. It's called, and I called it Brooklyn with an I.
When you said it, I was going to ask, because that is the perfect title.
Brooklyn with an I, Ontario. In really small letters underneath.
Just have the road sign to indicate.
Welcome to Brooklyn.
Exactly where you are. So the, have you ever, I just wanted to ask now that it's come up, have you ever considered doing a military thing? Would you
want to? I've had a couple of producers when I talked about my father's story who've really... emphasize it. I just started thinking about it recently, just because I guess I'm getting older, and I'm like, you know, I'm hitting the middle age, and I'm like, oh, if I'm going to do it, I better do it. I think just because of what it is, I'm feeling very precious about it, and that's like the worst thing for a writer is to be precious about it. So I'm working on it in my way, which means it'll take a long time. But yeah, I want to eventually get that story out there because the scenes. And his story of when he came here and all that it's all really interesting. And there is some dramatic line in there. I'm trying to find a way to get into it and this is the curse, right? The way to get into it that's different, that's right. Interesting. And then you curse yourself because you're trying to be so interesting and so different. So eventually I'll get either drunk enough or tired enough, or I'll just fucking write something about it.
Right.
But that's, you know, what's funny is Less Than Kind was about me and my father when I wrote that, but that was easier than just doing my father's story.
Sure.
Because I feel very precious about it, and that's what's killing it. Is every time I approach it, I'm approaching it, oh, that's not good enough. That's the writer dilemma.
Right.
So, you know, meanwhile I'll work on other things. It's just sort of always put a note or write a scene or just throw that into a pile, and eventually I'll just throw it out on a table and say, okay, let's see if I can piece something together here.
Cool.
But it feels like there's a very strong story there, maybe even too epic for me to even define.
Hmm. Yeah, it definitely sounds like a narrative. I mean, there is a narrative there. The war itself gives it a structure.
And then he lost his family, and then he found his father at the end, and they came to Canada, and that was...
And how old was he at the time?
When the war broke out?
Yeah,
when the tanks rolled in, he was like 12 or 13.
Okay, so he goes, like, and there you go, too, coming of age story.
It's all, yeah, yeah, and then he, like, but and then it was all kind of over when he was like 17, 18, mm-hmm. And at that point, he was like a great smuggler. He was like, spoke 7 languages, but it was all street language, like, he said, because he was... Basically, all he was doing was stealing and trading stuff.
Yeah.
And that's all he grew up knowing how to do. and he was in Italy, and there was an area, there was a market in Italy in, I think it was Rome. Was it Rome? I have to go back and look. And there was a market where a lot of the Jews hung out. And he said at the end of the day, the market was closing down, and there was a guy staring at him in the market. And he looked at him, and he looked back, and the guy just called out his name. He went, Aaron? And it was his father. And he hadn't seen his father in like 4 years. And his father had survived the war because his father was in the Polish army and was treated as a prisoner of war. He wasn't treated as a Jew.
Okay.
So he didn't get sent. But his mother and his two sisters were sent to the camp. Jeez. And so he found his dad at the end. It was like, and when my dad describes that scene, I'm like, holy shit, that's like, you know, that this is like, those are like epic, like kind of scenes. And I've never written something in that. And I'm imposing, of course, this preciousness on it because of you know, it was told to me. So, you know, those sort of moments were like, there's a story here. I got to write this eventually. Mm-hmm. Before I die, it'll be my last thing that I'll hit return on the keyboard and then I'll expire.
Well, it's good to have a plan.
Yeah, that's it. That's my plan. So I'll write it right at the end.
Okay. Well, in that case, given the framework... not including that, is there anything of Breaker Morant that you've already incorporated or used or relied upon elsewhere in your work? Is it somewhere in your creative DNA?
Well, I think that cynicism, I mean, you mentioned the web series I tried to do. There is like that dark sort of cynical attitude towards death and towards authority as well. I think I've absorbed that. I love the nobility of characters who are doing horrible things, yet they're still somehow noble. There's something so interesting about that to me, like from the Tony Soprano to like all of those characters who you can cheer for, yet they're really horrible people. Mm-hmm. Like you shouldn't be cheering for that guy. That those sort of heroes always turn my crank. They always get me revved up. So if I can absorb that, if I absorbed anything, it probably is that. And I would like to say that I would learn from the simplicity of the structure of it, the way it's laid out. Like, it's so simple, and it's like this is the simple goals of the characters and how clearly they're defined. Like, that sort of... it's so clean in that way. Mm. That really, that's something to strive for me as a writer, to not make it over complex, to not impose so many layers that it's a layer cake that it just becomes a mess. That you can, right, you can make things simple and elegant. And I think that's what Breaker Morant does that very, very well.
Yeah. And it does it in a way that is invisible.
Right? Yes.
Like, not only is it doing an elegant job of telling the story, it is doing an elegant job of convincing you that it's not. That it's simply existing.
Yes, that's it. It's simply existing, and that is brilliant. If you can get away with that, and nobody's applauding, going, "Oh, what a witty writer!
Yeah.
How wonderful!" Then, although I did do that earlier, I said, "Oh, what great writing!"
Yeah. But it's a good bit.
But that is something I think every writer can strive for, every actor as well. And you know, I was an actor before as a writer, and I'm still acting now. But those are really things to strive for and to learn, that, and this movie can teach you that at least.
Yeah. For such a bleak film, I mean, a film that leaves you with almost nothing.
Yeah.
It's remarkable just how much it does do. I'm still trying to reconcile the whole, well, how is this a popular film? How is this a success at the time? And it's...
Well, when you say it was a success, you mean like...
It ran for years.
Yeah.
It didn't go away. And a time when, I mean, films ran, but it was... the art house success.
And I imagine it was, the budget on it was nothing.
Yeah. And of all the films that came out of the Australian New Wave, I think this and Mad Max were the two that really hung on. And Mad Max was a completely
different, very different movie.
Yeah. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, Gallipoli was successful too. About a year later.
Yeah.
But the thing that I meant to say earlier, and I completely blew past it, is that this other point, Australia was in Vietnam as well. There were Australian soldiers in Vietnam, which I always forget.
Oh, right.
But maybe that's part of it, too. legacy.
The horrors
movies.
Of war, yeah.
Yeah, because you just roll right out of the war, which ended in 76, I think, right? Was when they pulled out.
Yeah, I'm not going to guess on the number because I'll look stupid.
Yeah, well, I know we got an angry email over my saying that Kong Skull Island takes place in 1973 at the end of the Vietnam War, which is established in the film that the Vietnam War is over in 1973 when the super appears on the screen. Yeah. And this person took exception and said, well, the fall of Saigon wasn't until 1975, and really hostilities didn't cease until 1976. Okay, but the giant monkey in the movie isn't a problem. But that's where I'm getting 1976.
I love those people who do that. Yeah. I think it's so great that someone has, like, especially when it's a movie about a giant monkey that they've gone through. Wait a minute. Like, you got to get some in touch with reality there, yeah. Norm.
Those guns didn't exist
in that era. Yeah, yeah, but the giant monkey's cool with you. Okay, yeah, it's good. Yeah. I think that the people who do that, like, they are just fantastic.
They're very special.
They're very special. They're
very special people. And they keep sending me emails.
Do they say?
Just wait until they see Cars 3.
Oh, really?
So many unanswered questions in Cars 3.
My thanks to Marvin Kaye, who can currently be seen stealing at least one scene in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water in theaters now. You can also stream at least one season of his show, Less Than Kind, on the TMN Go app in Canada. You can find Marvin on Twitter at MarvinKaye, all one word, and keep an eye out for the next thing at facebook.com/hitonmeseries. You can find Breaker Morant on Blu-ray and DVD in a fine restoration from the Criterion Collection. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. Here's to 2018 being better than 2017 in every conceivable way. That'd be nice.
I'm afraid you're just too darn...